Excuse me, everyone. This is the operator, and I just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you, Lori. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Working Group call on Wednesday, 14th of August, 2013. On the call today, we have Tim Bykoff, Elizabeth Finberg, Stefan Hankins, David Hisley, David Maher, Jude Lauter, Griffin Barnett, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickett, and Zoe Mahler, who is here for Catherine Gubin. We have apologies from Osvaldo Novoa, Kieran Mallon-Jarreville, Alan Greenberg, Guylaine Fournet, Wolfgang Kleinwachter, and Chuck Gomes, who will probably come here for the second hour. He is on another meeting. And from staff, we have Mary Wong, and myself, Julia Chavolin. May I please remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Julia. My name is Thomas Rickert, and I'm chairing this group. For today's meeting, you see the agenda in front of you in the Adobe. So our plan is to review the work plan, which we haven't done for a while, but now there's actually something to report on that. Then we will discuss public comments, review the protection matrix that you received well in advance of the meeting, and we will also talk about the confirmation of the next meeting. As for the second half of the first agenda item, I'd like to ask whether there are any updates to statements of interest. Hearing and reading none in the chat from you. Actually, I have an update to announce, which will enter into force on the 2nd of September, when CentralNIC is going to have its IPO, and I've been asked to serve as a non-executive director for that company, which I have accepted. I should say, though, that I will not represent that company in the ICANN arena. I've been asked to advise them strategically, as I do for other clients as well. But you already find that information in my SOI in the Confluence system on the ICANN website. And with this, I guess we can move to the second agenda item, which is the review of the work plan. And I was wondering, Barry, whether you could show us through the timing that we've now inserted there.
Yes, Thomas. This is Barry with ICANN staff. Essentially, what we have here is a timeline that takes us up to the Buenos Aires meeting based out of what our activities in Durban and our activities during our last two working calls, we've recognized that it's time to try to develop a set of recommendations or a proposal for identifier protections across the four groups. We're hopeful that we can try to accomplish that over the next two meetings to come up with a core set of actual recommendations for the final report. At which time we hope to submit for a formal consensus call, which is essentially will be on the list outlining the recommendations and receive written feedback from the stakeholders of the working group as to their views about the recommendations. If all goes according to plan, we'll complete the final report with the final recommendations loaded within the report, as to which we're mandated to put out for public comment. That'll be 21 days for the comment, 21 days for the reply period. And parallel, so that would take us through 5 September when we initiate the public comment forum. We have a number of meetings that are on the plan, and we'll determine whether we need to use those as a working group or not. And that'll essentially take us into the end of September when the comment period closes, and after which then we can start to compile those comments and as a working group come back together, review those final comments, prepare the final draft or the final report. The intent here, though, is we have an opportunity to try to conclude our efforts and present the final report to the GNSO Council by the 21st of October. And I think what's important about achieving this through the timeline is that if we can make this will allow enough of an opportunity for not only the council to deliberate and vote on any recommendations from this working group, but it should also give the rest of the community an opportunity to deliberate about the final recommendation in preparation for the meeting in Buenos Aires. Again, this is kind of a very tight timeline, especially given the 42 days with regards to public comment. And the only last thing I'll say is, looking through this timeline, there is a council meeting that is planned for the 10th of October. And if we've met the previous milestones in terms of preparing the recommendations and final report and public comment, Thomas will be briefing the GNSO Council about those recommendations, even though we haven't concluded in our public comment period. But the hope is to attempt to bring everybody up to speed about the recommendations, answer any questions or concerns, so that if this does become a motion for the 31st of October Council meeting, we try to mitigate any chance for the vote to be pushed out into November into Buenos Aires. So somewhat of an aggressive timeline. We do have a little bit of slack in terms of other activities that the working group may need to do between, especially through the month of September. But if we miss the 5 September time frame to initiate a public comment, then that would jeopardize the 31st of October and thus move us into the November Buenos Aires meeting. So that's all I have for now. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Thanks very much, Barry. Are there any questions from your side? While you think of questions, let me add to what Barry said that certainly the timeline as outlined is quite ambitious, but we think it's feasible. We think that we've looked at the issues put in front of us from all angles, and we think that we are shortly before being ready to do a consensus call. For those of you who are not too familiar with the GNSO Council's activity, it is not unusual for the Council to be presented with a motion and then one or multiple groups represented in the Council not having had enough time to deliberate the motion, so that the councillors representing the respective group or groups would ask for a deferral, so that the motion is tabled on the subsequent meeting of the GNSO Council. Usually, it is best practice, or it is common practice in the GNSO Council, that such requests for deferral are approved, and I would very much like to lower the chances for that to happen and give all groups in the GNSO sufficient time to look at where we at and discuss internally how they view the set of recommendations that the working group has come up with. You know, should we have any, certainly I should add. And for that to happen, and I want to make this utmost clear, it is not my plan to put the recommendations before the council, because the planned meeting or the envisaged meeting is held while the public comment period is still open. So in no way shall this be mistaken as establishing facts before public comment has been fully incorporated into the working group's thinking. But you will remember that I have briefed the council on our progress and our activities and the current state of thinking inside the working group multiple times, and I would like to use the opportunity of that meeting to give the council such update. So this shall not be mistaken as a premature submission of a motion to the council, which it is not, but it's just an updating of the council to reduce the risk of a of a referral, sorry, being asked for. I should also add that the date and my intervention at the council meeting is still tentative. I have not yet reached out to the council leadership. I've not yet asked for them to provide me with speaking time on the council's agenda, but I will certainly do so immediately after our call, should you agree with our work plan as just presented in general. I should also add that we have chosen to use such a tight timeline for multiple reasons. I guess number one, it would be good for the working group to get things moved forward. I guess it might otherwise be quite frustrating if our discussions linger on and you don't really see results to them. The second aspect is that it was our aim to make possible a so-called expedited PDP. You will have heard me saying that earlier on. It's been tagged an expedited PDP by both the board as well as the GAC. You know, formally in the PDP rules, we don't have such thing as an expedited PDP, but basically what we were saying is that we were trying to do things as quickly as we can while taking into account full community consultation in the process. So that's also one reason of us moving forward quickly, or trying to move forward quickly with your help. And the third reason is that we certainly want to make sure, or at least not jeopardize the possibility of only, you know, very few, if any, TLDs being delegated into the route before we have completed our work. And I think that with the work plan that we've presented to you, chances would be good not only for our working group to complete its task, but also to give the council an opportunity to deliberate and vote on it, and then for the council to pass it on to the ICANN board for its approval. As you know, our recommendations would only then turn into a consensus policy should they ultimately be adopted by the ICANN board. If that takes place, then these consensus policies would need to be followed by all registries that have their accreditations with ICANN without the need of their contracts to be changed. And that would cover all new GTLDs as well as contractual relationships between ICANN and existing TLDs. With this, I would like to hear from you whether you have any objections, observations, or reservations with respect to this work plan. I hope to be able to take your silence as consent, which would be great, because certainly with this ambitious time plan, I think everybody is asked to look at documents and our proposed wording in a timely manner so that we can get things done. But this is very encouraging, so I guess I wouldn't even have needed to be that wordy with my remarks on this. Nonetheless, I wanted to ensure that that we're all on the same page with respect to timing and the steps towards the completion of our work. So thank you very much for this, and particularly thanks to Barry for showing us through the plan and actually having updated it. Let's then move to the third agenda item, which is the discussion of public comment. As you know, the public comment period, or I should better say the reply period within the public comment phase, has ended on August the 7th. We've started discussing this during last week's call already, but the usual practice for dealing with public comment is that public comments are analyzed, sliced into bits and pieces, and put into the public comment review tool, which you see in front of you. So what happened here is basically that ICANN staff, and then, you know, Barry in particular, has analyzed the public comment and put it into this document to see whether there are new arguments that have been brought forward so that the working group can go through them individually and see whether there is any action required in response to the public comment. Now, at the risk of repeating partially or even in total what has already been said during last week's call, we would like to offer to the working group the opportunity of taking a slightly different approach for this public comment period. You will have noted that both for the public comment period as well as during the on-site meeting in Durban, we had the hope that people outside the working group or representatives of organizations or entities that are not yet represented inside the working group would bring forward new aspects, new arguments, new approaches that would enlighten the working group to an extent that we could actually come up with different or additional recommendations than we have at the table than we have on the table now. It has shown, though, that both during the meeting as well as during the public comment period, those that have already brought forward their views and perspectives in the course of the work of the working group have publicly stated those in the public comment period. Now, and I've said this last week already, I thank all of those who've taken the trouble and the energy to make public comments for having done so, because I think this is a vital aspect of ICANN's multi-stakeholder approach and community work, that people see who says what, because otherwise they might not fully see it. So I guess it was great of great to see all the public comments that have been made. Having analyzed those public comments carefully, we have spotted, though, and you will have to confirm with us whether you share that view or not, that number one, the contributors in the public comment period equal or are a subset of the contributors of this working group, and that the positions that they have taken are at least more or less the positions that have already been brought forward in the course of our work and that have already been part of our deliberations and that have influenced at least the set of provisional recommendations that we've come up with. So having said that, we would suggest to you that we do not move or walk through the public comment tool or review tool line by line. We think that we can take a different approach or suggest to you a different approach also because we have not included a set of recommendations that has been the result of a consensus call already. You will remember that we have that we've taken a different road in order to get new perspectives, as I said earlier. Usually, the initial report would have in it the results of a consensus call, and we don't have that yet, which is why we think that we can also deviate from usual practice a little bit. I would very much like to hear your view on that. Again, we would suggest not to go through the public comments line by line. We've analyzed those. We didn't spot any additional information apart from potentially the request by the RCRC, which we've started to discuss during last week's call. And that also has been highlighted, so we think we've extracted those parts of the public comment that would need special attention of the working group. Now, with this, I would like to hear from you whether you agree to not moving through the document line by line, which otherwise we would, certainly would.
Thomas?
Jim?
Yes. First, I want to thank you and Barry and Barry for all the hard work on this effort over the course of the working group conferences, which, have, as we know, have been going on for a long, long time. I think your plan is a good one, and we support moving forward as fast as possible because of the, as we all know, the rumors of delegation, the beginning of delegation as early as September. I think it's in everybody's interest to move to a call, consensus call, as soon as possible and move to complete the work of the group.
Thanks so much, Jim. I see David's hand up. David, please.
I agree with that. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Are there any objections to the approach that I've suggested to you? Hearing and reading none. I thank you all for your collaboration with this. Should you identify any issues that would require the working group's special attention after the call, please let me know, and we'll make sure to address that. You know, this is, you know, it is not our intention to suppress any points that have been raised. Our intention is to do things as diligently as we can, yet being conscious of time and move forward quickly. Thank you so much. And that allows us to move to the fourth agenda item, which is the review of the protection recommendation and also the preparation of a consensus call. I'm sure that Barry, who is the person, again, who has come up with the spreadsheet, is in a much better position to show you through it and explain to you how it works. However, I would like to make two or three little remarks before I hand over to Barry. The idea is that we actually test whether my assessment of the consensus level inside the working group is accurate. For those who are not too familiar with the processes and the procedures for policy development working groups, it is the chair's task to determine whether and what level of consensus there is inside the working group. You will have seen this already. You know, we have different levels of consensus. We do not vote. And I have, you know, the burden is on me to see what the level of consensus inside the working group is. And I have tried to test the waters for consensus earlier, as you will remember, and these findings have gone into my thinking for this tool, as well as the deliberations we had thereafter. So the plan is that we double-check whether my assessment was accurate, but not only whether my assessment is accurate, but also for each and everyone inside the working group to see whether we've missed something and whether we've actually taken a look at the issue before us from all perspectives. And should this assessment that we're going to test in a moment be accurate, then those fields that did not find support by the working group, and those are at least the fields that you now see in front of you with the word no in it, those will then disappear because they would not make it to the set of recommendations for a consensus call. And we would then transform the table format of the recommendations matrix into text format so that it would actually read like a draft motion that can be put in front of the GNSO Council. So the motions would then be the result, or sorry, the recommendations in Word format would be the result of transforming the matrix into a motion. I hope that I have almost accurately phrased that. And I guess it's now a good time for me to pass on to Barry again, who can also make some introductory remarks on what we're doing now.
Great. Thank you, Thomas. This is Barry. So carrying on with what Thomas mentioned, essentially the matrix that you see before you, there's definitely a couple of points that I'd like to bring up. First and foremost, those on the working group, you know, this attachment was sent out to you as we work through each cell of each recommendation option at the top and second level. I'd probably advise that it may be easier for you to follow on your own machine. What you see before you is a PDF printed version, although the Zoom is very large. It may not be very effective to follow along in terms of when we traverse each cell. So first and foremost, the column A, which is basically the recommendation options that were essentially extracted from our initial report. You'll notice that not all of them are there, but a majority of them are. The ones that aren't, basically, there wasn't, there was hardly any support or, I should back that up. The ones that aren't there are basically the opposites of the recommendations that were there. So as an example, for top-level protections, we've distinguished between exact match full names and acronyms of the identifiers that would be added to ineligible for delegation in the applicant guidebook. We also had two recommendations from our initial report that said no top-level protections of full name or acronym, because there did seem to be a little bit more support for some sort of protections at the top level. I removed those two that said no protection. And then, as you'll also see, that if we did include things like fee waiver, where it was there seemed to be no support for fee waivers at the top level, but just to ensure that we captured that there was no support, that one was included. And as Thomas noted earlier, once we've reviewed through the entire matrix and we see a complete row response of no support for it, like you said, those will eventually be removed from this matrix because there's really no need to create a recommendation that there was no support for to begin with. The other thing, other takeaway from this chart is that very similar to when the working group deliberated on eligibility criteria, our attempt was to come up with a single unification eligibility criteria. After deliberations, the working group realized that that wasn't necessarily possible, but in light of the recommendation option, or so what we wound up doing is that essentially eligibility criteria would be defined by the four groups themselves, or the two organizations that are INGOs but not necessarily included with INGOs. So essentially I call them four groups, and that's columns B, C, D, and E. And so we try to take the same approach here that in terms of reviewing each recommendation option, it made sense to break it out by the four group types as well, which is kind of the structure of the matrix. The other thing that I'll point out is, so you'll see that it's divided between top-level recommendation options as well as second-level recommendation options. And then there's a third area of the chart that is based on what I've titled as Scope 1 and Scope 2, which is basically the scope of identifiers that are being considered across the four organizations. So when we review through the matrix, we'll probably start here with the scope delineation of the identifiers across the four groups, and then we'll be able to move up and start to review each of the top and second level recommendation options. And then lastly, what I'd like to point out, and we discussed briefly over at in our last call, there's also a fifth column here as a placeholder for any discussions that we have about any recommendations that the working group may support and what their impact may be on the existing GTLDs. This particular column is most likely not necessary in terms of a consensus call, because any recommendations that we come up with are applicable to all GTLDs. However, there may be some implementation considerations, and or the working group may determine that there are some subtle policy recommendations that may need to accompany these. So this will certainly be the last part of our exercise as we review through this matrix. But for the most part, this is a topic that hasn't been deliberated much and that needs to be in terms of meeting the requirements of our charter. So with that, that's kind of a high-level review of what the matrix is and how it's mentioned. And I think I see Claudia had mentioned a few items in the chat. So in terms of basically Claudia has mentioned in terms of minority positions about certain recommendations, the reason why those, the fee waivers here are stating that there is a, as an example, we'll look at row four for the fee waivers at a top level. The reason why it's a blanket statement of no is, again, this is a chair's perception that we wouldn't even receive strong support and significant opposition in terms of our ladder of consensus levels. It would maybe be a different designation if he did detect that there was closer to a consensus on that particular recommendation. And just note that these are his initial impression. We're going to review each cell by cell, and there's nothing that says that these can't or won't change. Through our deliberations as we move through each one, they most certainly can. The scope may change, et cetera. So this is a dynamic document. It's not static and written in stone. And then lastly, in terms of trying to formulate these recommendations as we move to a consensus call and update the final report, one important component to the final report is if there are minority positions about a set of recommendations, minority report can be attached into the final report itself, or I should say minority position. So if, for example, as we traverse through this chart and it still seems that there's not strong support, if there's not a level of strong support and significant opposition for a particular recommendation, but a particular stakeholder has still a firm position about that said recommendation, that can be a part of that minority position statement within the final report that will obviously be delivered not only to the GNSO Council for their consideration, but it will move its way up in terms of the board reviewing through the recommendations and the minority positions as well. So I don't think that there will be any suppression of minority statements here, but the main goal here is to whittle the possible recommendations down to a set framework of what these recommendations will that gain the most support that will then, in turn, be deliberated and voted on by the GNSO Council.
And Barry, if I can add, we will get to the cell that deals with fee waivers. So working group members, in addition to Claudia, can then speak up, and we will then see whether the perspective of the group has changed. You will have seen, you will note as we move on, that my assessment of the level of consensus or the lack thereof for protections for INGOs has changed since those organizations have received more support during the last couple of calls. David, please.
Well, I'm concerned about the indication in box F6. The yes, vote one, and also F16, yes for scope one. Scope 1, as I understand it, includes a list of INGO names, and it's still the position of the registry stakeholder group that there should be no special protections for INGO names, with the exception of the Red Cross and the Olympic Committee, which are, we treat separately.
Thanks, David. I understand that this was or still is the position of the registries, but in our recent discussions, there was a change of some groups that have formally spoken out against protections for INGOs, which have then stated that looking at the protection of public interest, they would not see a difference between protections for IGOs versus INGOs. And this is the reason why I have included this, as you see it on the screen in front of you. But please let's bear your comment in mind. And in order to structure our discussion, I would suggest that we actually move through the sheet cell by cell to see whether we identify more areas where there are diverging views on what I've put in there. Barry, I'm not sure in terms of procedure, would you like to go through the cells and we then do the test and I would take back over when there's a discussion?
Absolutely. So, again, I recommend that we kind of start with a review through the scope of the identifiers themselves by the organization type, and I think that this really carries on forward with David's question. As we get over to the INGOs, that's where we'll start having that discussion. So, essentially what you're seeing here, there's two rows that depict Scope 1 and Scope 2 identifiers, and the reasoning for these distinctions is, of course, I think partially recognizing what work has already been performed by the board based on the GAC advice, and then, of course, in terms of deliberations within the working group about an additional set of identifiers that may or may not be applicable by organization type. So we'll start off with the Red Cross. And here we have listed for Scope 1 as being the identifiers that were originally submitted from the GAC advice that is now inclusion in the draft registry agreement, which are the designations of Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Lion, Red Sun, and Red Crystal per the UN 6 language. Now, there's a delineation of what are considered Scope 2 names, which have been recent discussions but have been posted to the working group for some time, that the Red Cross is also asking for the 189 recognized National Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies, as well as 6 acronyms, et cetera. And then there's also the language scope. So I think that there's been some deliberation about whether these Scope 2 names should be given the possible protections that we have identified up top, or should they be considered separately, or is there no support for providing protections for these additional designations, and thus the reasoning for Scope 1 and Scope 2. And before I turn this back to Thomas about this particular topic, the idea here was, in terms of the types of recommendation options that are available to us, it may include Scope 1 or may not include Scope 2, and that's why that they're specifically called out in particular cells of the recommendation option type. So, Thomas, I think I'll kind of open up the floor about the discussion of just the Red Cross designations that we have here. And if first, I guess, if working group members agree that there should be consideration between the two and then deliberate about whether the scope of identifiers needs to be grouped together more as Scope 1. And the reason, again, and I think which is probably a little bit more of an example, is that, you know, in with respect to the IGOs. There has been much more support for providing full protections for full names of IGOs, whereas the protections for acronyms may be somewhat of a different nature than full name reservations that have been discussed thus far, and hence why there's the delineation between Scope 1 and Scope 2 names, because each one of the recommendation options may apply a little bit differently based on the scope of those names. But I hope that that's clear in my babble, and hopefully we can move forward with defining, or at least at this point, acknowledging that there is a difference between the scope of these designations as we move through the matrix.
Thanks very much, Barry. Any comments? And I'd like you to speak up in particular if you think that the scope should be different or that there shouldn't be a yes but a no, for example, which would surprise me because there has been quite some support for exact match full name identifiers, but I guess the question what the level or what scope should be comprised is maybe a little bit more controversial. Okay, so please do speak up. Should you, at a later stage during our discussions, find that we need to get back to the cell, but so far I would understand that the level of consensus that we've grasped here would be accurate, at least perceived to be accurate by the participants of this call, which then allows us to move to the next cell. Barry.
All right, thank you, Thomas. So Row Charlie, which I believe, or Row C, is the International Olympic Committee designations. Again, there's a breakout of Scope 1, Scope 2. However, the IOC is only asking for protections of two identifiers in the UN 6 plus German, Greek, and Korean, which is already outlined in the current approved, I misspoke earlier. I said it was a draft, but I believe it's an approved registry agreement now. These particular identifiers are outlined in Specification 5 as the scope of those that are being requested for protection. And as you'll see here, Scope 2 is not applicable, primarily because there's no ask for any acronyms or other designations, unlike for the Red Cross. I think that one's pretty easily understood. If there are no questions, I'll move over to the IGO column. And as I mentioned earlier, again, the reason why that there's a separation of Scope 1 and Scope 2 names is that particular protection options apply differently between the full name of the organization versus their more recognizable acronym of the said organization. And these differences will probably become more clear as we review through the recommendations options themselves as we move through the list. And if there are no questions for the IGO names, then I'll move over to the INGO names. And as we picked up off of David's question and Thomas's response, so in general, I think up to this point, and correct me if I'm misspeaking, but up until the last few meetings, there wasn't a recognition that there was enough support in terms of the INGO identifier protection. But what we found out in the last couple of meetings that there does seem to be a lot more traction in this part. And Thomas, please correct me if I'm wrong here. I think the reason that we're including content within the scope of identifiers for the INGOs is not so much that, at least for these two cells, it's not so much an initial impression of where consensus may lie, but that these are really two cells that we need to deliberate in the working group. So more specifically, the scope one for identifiers, we really still have two options on the table. The working group has mentioned in the past about the use of the ECOSOC list, And certainly there's the distinctions within that list between general consultative status and special consultative status. The general consultative status is a list of about approximately 200 names. I can't remember the last count. Whereas the special consultative status is 2,000 plus names. And then the other option to consider, which is something that the working group has deliberated on, is a different framework, which is the eligibility criteria that was submitted by the ISO and the IEC. And I think there has been attention paid to that eligibility criteria, but I think one of the unknowns about that list of eligibility criteria is what is the output from that list or from that set of criteria. Does it mean that it's a list of 10 INGOs, 200 INGOs, 2,000? So I think there needs to be some use cases applied to what the output of that criteria may actually result. But as I mentioned, here within the Scope 1 realm is the list of or the option of the ECOSOC list and or the eligibility criteria, and it's going to be up to the working group to figure out how we nail this down in terms of trying to move forward with a set of identifiers that would be protected. Whereas then on the Scope 2 row also mentions the ECOSOC list, but those that only have or that have special consultative status versus the ones that have general consultative status. And so as we move forward in terms of trying to truly gauge the consensus level, these will flush out as we review through the recommendation options. So that's kind of wraps up our review of the scope of identifiers. Hopefully these distinctions are a little bit clearer, and I think, again, as we move through the options themselves, we'll refer back to what the difference is between Scope 1 and Scope 2 to help provide clarity for that recommendation option.
Thanks very much, Barry. I guess this was most useful. And just to fill you in on a little bit of my thinking with this, there's been a history to our discussions. As you will remember, the working group in its very early phase tried to come up with a set of criteria that need to be fulfilled by organizations that would benefit from protections that the working group would grant or recommend to grant. And we have not been able to determine such list of or such a set of criteria for the four categories of organizations that we're looking at. There have been arguments that we would need to look at the public interest of the organizations. There was the question of who is needy or worthy of protections. And most of the criteria that have been brought forward by working group members have been perceived to be arbitrary by other parts of the working group. So the working group has not been able to come up with a set of eligibility criteria for the organizations. And in this context, we also struggled with the criteria that have been proposed for INGOs by ISO and IEC. The work that the approach that we took then, I guess it was by the Beijing meeting, took a little bit of a different route when there were developments at the board and the GAC level, because there was a list that was produced. The working group learned that the list that was on the table is not as frighteningly long as some may have thought, which is why the group then sort of moved to the idea of not using criteria that we make up or that we invent and that some third party, if not ICANN, needs to test against the reality with the organizations that are asking for protections. So taking a list that is produced by the GAC or having a conclusive list, as we see here in the in scope one, for example, was something that the group pretty much liked. And what you see here in cell F39 is basically an amalgamation of the thinking of the working group over the last couple of months. We've been talking about the ECOSOC list early on, but that was in the phase where we tried to come up with our own criteria, and also the ECOSOC list was perceived by some as being too long to be taken into account for protections. Now that we've taken the list for IGOs in particular, the working group has developed a new dynamic, because some then said, okay, if we protect or if we grant protections for the IGOs, we do think that INGOs, if they have a certain degree of international government support, also deserve the same level of protections, because they also serve the global public interest. And this is sort of what you find here. We have the shorter ECOSOC list, which, as Claudia now says, is, if memory doesn't fail her, only 140 entries long. That would be a list that can be taken on an SS basis. ICANN would not have the burden of checking criteria against reality with the applying organizations. So we wouldn't have a too excessive list to take into consideration, and at the same time the global public interest might be adequately taken care of by respecting those designations. So this has been a long introduction to a simple question, and that is, do you agree with this approach? And I'm sure that at least David, who already said that he has an issue with this, would answer no, but I'd like to hear more views on that. Greg, please.
I'll break the ice. It's Greg Shatton, for the record. The IPC in debating this, I think, was looking more at the prior criteria than at the ECOSOC list. Looking at the issue of qualified INGOs and what that might mean, it seemed to be kind of a rabbit hole. And that while there were basically, as you can see from the public comments submitted, kind of a divergence of views on that. I'd be somewhat more optimistic that the ECOSOC list would gain traction if we focus solely on that as the criteria, since it's kind of, in terms of scope and scale, similar to the IGO list, I think focuses on organizations that are serving the global public interest and that are core participants in international civil society. So I can't speak for the IPC, but for myself, I think the ECOSOC list is, if there's going to be any protections for INGOs at this level in this manner, it would be that would be the basis for it. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Greg. One follow-up question. Talking about the ECOSOC list, you're agreeing with our distinction between Scope 1 and Scope 2? Or are you focusing on the general consultative status list as mentioned in cell F39?
Focusing on the general consultative list, the 140 names.
Okay. Thank you very much. And Claudia, you're next.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you. You know, I'm going to say what we've said before, which is that, you know, there is a beauty in using the list in the sense that there are a discrete number of organizations on the general consultative status at any particular time. It is a list that changes from year to year. I know that in 2010, I think there was around 39. I think there's some maybe less than a dozen more in 2011. But it is a rather discrete list. That being said, and here I would speak more on behalf of the IEC than ISO. We have been on the general consult status for quite some time. IEC, for example, is on the special consultative status. And one of the reasons why we had added in the criteria that we had jointly proposed is the idea of having the ability for a large NGO like IEC is, which might not, for whatever historical reason, have been on the general consult status, to show that it is still an international, a global organization that has member countries that expand the majority of the world, an ability to still get some kind of special protection. And in that situation, that's why we had added the criteria of showing that you had at least 50 plus member countries that were formally representing the activities of that country in its entirety to this INGO, which is the case of IEC. They have far more than 50 member countries. So that's just a little comment I wanted to say, because I know that my IEC counterpart is not here, so I just wanted to speak up for them. But that being said, we reiterate that there is a beauty in using the discrete list, but there is something that's lost there as well. I just wanted to highlight that for you.
Thanks very much, Claudia. I guess that, as I said, the working group was leaning towards an approach that would not require the assessment of eligibility on a case-to-case basis, but that could actually take a list that is created by a trustworthy third party on an as-is basis. But still, your point is very well heard. It was my assessment that that we would get more traction for using the ECOSOC list and not add any additional parameters to it, but certainly the question is out for discussion. So I would very much like to hear from other working group members whether they disagree with the ECOSOC list approach in its entirety, whether they think the ECOSOC list approach needs to be tweaked by adding additional parameter, and one of these parameters could be the one that Claudia just suggested, having the 50-plus formula in it, for example. So I'd very much like to hear views, perspectives from working group members, and I would also like to encourage David from the Registry Stakeholder Group maybe to speak up again. I do remember that we were talking about the beauty of taking lists that or approaches that can easily be implemented, and I guess that the ECOSOC General Consultative Status list would be such. And, since this is a relatively new idea that has been discussed, my question to the registries would be whether they would be willing to reconsider and maybe deliberate inside their stakeholder group whether this is something they could also support. David, you've thankfully raised your hand, so fire away.
Well, I don't see any likelihood that the stakeholder group will change its position. It's been discussed now quite a number of times, and my understanding within the stakeholder group is that there's complete agreement that INGO names simply do not deserve special protection, with the limited exception of the Red Cross and Olympic names. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Anybody else? Okay, I would suggest that we leave this for for a minute or two and move to the next cell, Barry, because we will surely get to cell, F20, where we then get back to the scope 2 protections for INGOs, which will give us another opportunity to discuss this matter. So, Barry, can I ask you to walk us through the next cells? And we'll get back to the discussion, just to be very clear on that, we'll get back to the discussion on F6 in a moment again.
Thank you, Thomas. So now basically we'll start reviewing through the top level and second level protection options per organization. And I guess, Thomas, I have a question for you. Should we continue on with the INGOs or move back over to the Red Cross and go through those, or just continue on the INGO as we basically will be reviewing the options by column while at versus when we were reviewing through the Scope 1, Scope 2 protections, that was a review by row. Now we're going to be moving to a column-based format.
No, I guess we should move on by going through the columns because it will be easier for us to concentrate on one group of organizations or on one organization after the other. And I guess that will certainly give the working group the opportunity to further think about the INGO or potential INGO protections while we discuss the same subject or the same questions for the other three types of organizations.
Okay, so you do want to continue on with the INGOs?
No, I would like to move on with the columns from left to right.
Okay, all right. So basically we'll start off with the Red Cross, Red Crescent, and we'll start off with top-level protections. So the first recommendation option is to provide protections of exact match full names and that these identifiers are placed into the applicant guidebook, the section titled Strings Ineligible for Delegation. And so the current consensus level is that, yes, for Scope 1 identifiers, that those identifiers would be placed in the applicant guidebook. And just to remind the working group, the Scope 1 identifiers for the Red Cross, Red Crescent, are the four designations that they have listed here that are in the UN 6. And again, just as a reminder, these are the protections that are currently placed in the registry agreement. The scope of these designations is what is placed in Specification 5 of the registry agreement, but again, that would apply to second-level protection. The applicant guidebook is what has these listed in the ineligible for delegation, although I think that there hasn't been a revision to the guidebook for some time. So these really apply to future versions of the applicant guidebook. But again, yes, for Scope 1 identifiers for exact match full name. Moving down is basically the same recommendation, but it's talking about acronyms. Originally, I think for the Scope 1 names, there was no listing of acronyms, but regardless, there didn't seem to be support across the working group for top-level protection of acronyms, and that's why you see no listed in this cell. And I'll continue. And if anybody has a question about a particular cell we're reviewing, please raise your hand or shout out if you can't raise your hand fast enough, and we'll stop and discuss that particular cell. Moving on to the third recommendation option is that identifiers reserved from any registration requires an exception procedure in cases where a protected organization wishes to apply for the protected string. We said yes for Scope 1 names because we are protecting the Scope 1 names in the applicant guidebook, and that an exception procedure would need to be developed. And I think that the registry's state position statement or public comments said it best that an exception procedure would need to be developed because we wouldn't see any reason why we wouldn't allow a protected organization to use their name in the future. That wasn't a direct quote, but I think I captured the essence of their statement. The recommendation itself is one thing. Yes, an exception procedure should be created. I think the implementation of it is a different aspect, and we can understand later from the board and the ICANN staff itself whether an existing procedure may already exist or whether one would truly need to be developed. But either way, it would satisfy the recommendation itself. And lastly, moving on, the last recommendation option for top-level protections is that INGO organizations be granted a fee waiver for filing objections for applied for GPLD at the top level. And the chair's read on this is that there was no consensus with respect to this recommendation. So that's kind of a preview of how we'll review each of these recommendations options by organization. I'll continue on now to the second level protection recommendations for the Red Cross. And what we have identified here, the first recommendation option, very much like the top level, is protection of exact match full name identifiers are placed in Specification 5 of the registry agreement. And the cell says yes for Scope 1 names. And, again, that's what we see currently deployed in the registry agreement now under Specification 5. You'll notice that presently it doesn't include the Scope 2 names because that's something that still should be deliberated by the working group. But for now, and primarily it doesn't include Scope 2 names because it didn't seem that there was enough support for Scope 2 names to receive the same kind of protection as the Scope 1 names. Moving down the next recommendation option, second-level protections for exact match acronym identifiers are placed in Specification 5 of the RA, and there didn't seem to be support for that, so the list is no for now. The third recommendation option is that second-level protections of exact match full name identifiers are applied for by the organization requesting protection and placed in a clearinghouse model and modified to accommodate use by IGOs and INGOs. I'll just remind the working group that we toned down our use of a clearinghouse model to a more generic phrase because we weren't sure whether the trademark clearinghouse could be used or not. Based on an agenda item from our last call and some discussions with experts on the TMCH, the trademark clearinghouse does seem like that could be a viable option if there is overwhelming support for this recommendation. But at the end of the day, the exact match full name identifiers are applied for by the organization requesting protection. So the response here is yes for Scope 2 names. Now, the reason why Scope 1 names are not listed here is because they're already reserved in Specification 5 of the registry agreement. Therefore, they wouldn't need to be placed into the trademark clearinghouse to seek protection that wouldn't be necessary. However, the response here is yes for Scope 2 names. And again, as a reminder, that Scope 2 names are the 189 designation of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies, as well as their acronyms and other UN languages. So that's where the delineation between Scope 1 and Scope 2 comes into play. So at this point, the response that, yeah, it's possible, or I'm sorry, it's wrong. That there could be support for at least allowing Scope 2 names to enter into the trademark clearinghouse. And I'll continue on down to the acronym protection. So again, there were no acronyms requested for Scope 1 names that would have been listed in Specification 5 of the registry agreement. The question is should acronyms be allowed into the clearinghouse model? And since there was no support for reservation of acronyms, the trademark clearinghouse is the next viable option. And we listed here yes for Scope 2 because those Scope 2 names include the six acronyms that the Red Cross Red Crescent has requested for. Okay, moving down, which talks about the sunrise phase of the trademark clearinghouse. Essentially, this is no across the board, but specifically for Red Cross, this is listed as no that there is, does not seem to be even strong support with significant opposition level of consensus about offering sunrise. Conversely, there does seem to be support for the 90-day claims notification during that launch period. And the reason that it has yes for Scope 2 names is, first, the Scope 1 names don't need the claims notification because, again, they're protected by Specification 5. However, we have listed yes for Scope 2 names, which are the additional designations requested by the Red Cross that they could get the claims notification for those identifiers. Moving down, mentions the fee waivers in terms of registering into the clearinghouse model. And at this point, there doesn't seem to be strong or near consensus about any fee waivers for the clearinghouse. I will remind the working group, though, if there is support for use of the trademark clearinghouse, there needs to be a determination by the working group as to how these organizations and their identifiers enter the clearinghouse. If the scope of identifiers is short defined list that can be entered in from a batch perspective into the clearinghouse, you could almost in a way maybe perceive that as a fee waiver because that entry into the clearinghouse would be less of a challenge, whereas if the recommendation for any participation in the trademark clearinghouse or claims, et cetera, is left up to the organization itself requesting protection, i.e. that it's on their responsibility to complete the form into the clearinghouse, there will have to be a back-end review process that ensures that, yes, this organization is on this list, so it could mean a little bit difference in terms of a cost perspective there. All right, moving down the list, which talks about the curative rights protections and access to URS and UDRP. This one is across the board. Yes, it seems that there is strong support by all these organizations to have access to URS and UDRP, but moving down, there didn't seem to be strong support for fee waivers for any URS or UDRP action. And then lastly, to create a registration exception procedure for wishing to register a second-level name by the organization seeking protection. And this is yes for Scope 1 names because, again, they're placed on Specification 5. We need some mechanism by which that would be removed so that that name could be registered by the organization seeking protection. It doesn't list Scope 2 names here because literally Scope 2 names are only in the clearinghouse, and if an organization that was protected wanted to register it, they would be able to work through that method and or apply for that name when general availability came out. So that's kind of the column capture of the scope of protection that seemed to have the most support with respect to Red Cross, Red Crescent. Any questions or discussion about any of these?
Thanks, Barry. I guess this has been an excellent run through the various items that we've been discussing. And while the other working group members think of questions or remarks they want to make, I would like to briefly get back to the question of a fee waiver and also the question of exception procedures, where I think we can take a route that we haven't discussed so much, but which may make our lives considerably easier. As regards fee waivers, I have seen a couple of remarks by Claudia in the chat who speaks out for support of fee waivers, and I know that a few inside the working group would also support the idea of fee waivers. In fact, even if we don't get consensus on fee waivers, which is my current assessment, that would not necessarily mean that there wouldn't be any fee waivers, because I guess we wouldn't go as far as making a recommendation that would be explicitly against fee waivers. So if our set of recommendations does not say anything about fee waivers, then it would still be open to the implementation of the recommendation, should they be adopted, to attach fee waivers to them. Also, and I will move to David, who has raised his hand in a moment, with respect to the exemption procedure, we could phrase a recommendation to say that there should be an exemption procedure for legitimate users of the designations that have been reserved or that have been put on a list, and then leave it to the implementation of ICANN staff or maybe the board even wishes to say something about that, how these exemption procedures can actually be operationalized. So I guess, you know, a statement from our group or a recommendation that would request an exemption procedure for legitimate users might do the trick and save us the work of developing a fully fleshed, fleshed out operational exemption procedure. David?
I just wanted to say that as a matter of policy, I think fee waivers are a mistake. It just introduces more complexity in the entire new GTLD process that we don't need at this time.
Thanks very much. That sort of supports the idea that I was just voicing, that the question of fee waivers does not necessarily need to be addressed in our set of recommendations. Thank you very much, David, and let's move to Claudia.
Hi, Thomas. I disagree. I think we do need to include, even if it is a minority position, a recommendation, for example, if there would be some who vote for it, for fee waivers. Just to highlight something that I feel that we continually forget, that whatever protection mechanisms that we recommend or that ultimately get accepted don't have to fly the gamut on just blocking or necessarily heavily restricted protections. There are other options, and I just think that as long as we highlight that, we're on I think safer ground, because there, I think that there's a lot more support in the group for, especially when it comes to things like acronyms, to have a balanced protection for these kind of designations. I'm not going to say anything else on fee waivers, but I am a little bit concerned about the exception procedures. I would be very concerned if, for example, we were to recommend something like, yes, acronyms should be blocked for IGOs and for the other two NGOs that have been included, and others, including that, and then some sort of exception procedure should be adopted. That could mean many different things, and I don't necessarily agree that that would just be an implementation issue. We don't really know then what we've recommended. Then it could either be an exception procedure that would entail lots of procedure, lots of money, lots of applications to ICANN, and quite frankly, a lot of organizations who are going to be scratching their heads afterwards and curious as to why, you know, three-letter, four-letter acronyms have suddenly been blocked when they've been using that for so long for their business name and for their trademark. So I think that if we, particularly in the case of acronyms, if we go for something like recommending a block and an exception procedure on top of that, we need to be very, very clear what kind of exception procedure we would mean. Maybe not the specifics. Maybe we would say we don't say that it would be necessarily a clearinghouse exception. For example, if the trademark is registered in the trademark clearinghouse, for example, then that would be a, you know, per se legitimate, and you would automatically be able to register it. Maybe we don't go to that level of detail, but we definitely need to say what kind of level of a procedure it would be, what kind of burdens we would be expecting, unknowing trademark owners out in the world to have to deal with because of the recommendations that we've made.
Thanks very much, Claudia. A couple of remarks. Number one, we do not vote. So our work is consensus-driven, so we're aiming at consensus positions. And you're certainly right that there is a huge variety of other options which you don't find in the table in front of you that could be deployed. But ultimately, we would need to get those options on the table that would find broad support within the working group. And we haven't seen that. So we have to live with what we have on the table, and we have amalgamated the recommendations that got most traction into this one document. And should we not come up with other mechanisms that find broad support, I guess they can't go into the set of recommendations. Your remarks regarding the acronyms, if you look at the proposals that Barry has outlined, we would have a TMCH equivalent approach for them with a trademark claims notice. So for most of the acronyms, there would not be any block. And with respect to the exception procedures, let me just say that we have been discussing exception procedures for quite a while, and we've seen an outline of an exception procedure, and this has been discussed. But there has been quite a controversy on what an exception procedure might look like. I guess that there is almost unanimity inside the group that if there is protection for certain designations, that this shall not prevent legitimate use from actually taking place. So the one fact that we have, I guess, even full consensus on is that legitimate use must be possible, even if we recommend protections. What we did not have consensus on, and I would even go as far as saying that there is divergence, is whether the exception needs to be authorized by the organization in question, whether an independent third party needs to be involved with that, and all those niceties. So I guess that we should try to condense the common ground, and if we can't agree on a specific implementation of an exception procedure in terms of, you know, crafting the policy surrounding it, I guess it would be good enough for a policy to recommend that legitimate use must still be possible. But I don't want to dwell on that for too long, because I'm sure that Chuck, who has raised his hands, wants to add to that.
Thanks, Thomas, and sorry for joining late, but my other call interfered with this. I have first of all, fees are designed to cover the costs of the process. If we waive fees, we still have to pay for the costs of the process. Who pays for that cost if we waive fees?
Which is an additional argument for not including the fee question in our set of recommendations.
Well, and it can be, but I think we have to face that question. I don't know if Claudia has a response to that or if somebody else does, but that's a reality. There are costs to the process. Those costs need to be covered. If we waive fees, who would cover them?
Well, that's a good question. And actually, Chuck, what you see in the chart in front of you is my current assessment of the level of consensus. And the outcome of that, at least for the moment, is that there is no support in the working group for fee waivers. And if the IEC and the IOC are of the opinion that this should be included, that could actually go into a minority statement, and maybe the board picks up on it. But I do not see even strong support for fee waivers. So unless we find a different view of other working group members that would change my assessment of the consensus level as chair, I think as chair I do not have any alternative than sticking to my assessment, which you find in the table. Chuck, does that at least answer your question or the discussion surrounding it?
Thanks, Thomas. Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks, Chuck. Claudia, I'm not sure whether your hand was raised again or whether it's still up.
It's raised again, Thomas.
Okay. It's your turn.
thank you. I won't pretend to be able to get into the complexities of ICANN calculus when it comes to the fees and the amount of money that they've received for applications or whatnot and whatever surplus they may have. But I will say that, you know, we can put it in perspective what a fee waiver might look like. If there's only, let's say, 150, and if we use the ISO IEC criteria, I think that there'll be far less than 150 organizations that could qualify. But if there are only, say, 150, and out of those, only some of them will want to even have or even know about this program and want to protect their name or their acronym or their designation. We're not talking about that much in terms of, for example, if the cost is $150 for an entry into the Trademark Clearinghouse, or as I think it was Barry who mentioned, if it's on a list and it's just going to be placed in, you know, in a batch list, then it's not necessarily that cost prohibitive. When it comes to, you know, objections, for example, if ICANN could give some sort of applicant support, whether it be, you know, putting the bill for, let's say, a $10,000 you know, objection, or perhaps providing some other type of technical assistance, whether it be helping the organization understand you know, the situation, understanding its possibilities to file an application, or whatever ICANN could come up with in terms of helping a possible you know, nonprofit INGO to make sure that there's not going to be confusion with its name. I don't think it's going to be that cost prohibitive if we word it correctly and if we think about the scope. Hearing very much what you're saying, Chuck. And the other thing I wanted to say very quickly was, Thomas, I wanted to ask you actually is something. So if we're going to be excluding any possible recommendations on this chart that say no or that you feel say no, does that mean that we're not going to be seeing, for example, a possible recommendation to block acronyms? That would be something that would not be even available for the consensus call. Would that also mean that how far does this go? I'm just trying to understand.
Our aim is to come up with a set of recommendations that that huge parts of the community could consent to. So we can't possibly include things there that would make the whole consensus call fail. So you are right assuming that something that does not get sufficient traction will not be included in the set of recommendations. Nonetheless, your point is well heard. It's well documented. It's been covered in the initial report already, and each of the groups that is not able to support the consensus can have a minority statement to give their diverging view special visibility. So that option is always there, and as we identified earlier, it is very well possible that the ICANN board chooses to deal with the fee question differently, in a different way than the working group sees it.
So then does that mean, Thomas, just to clarify, so does that mean, for example, we won't see the possible recommendation for an exact match acronym? That won't be part of the consensus call because I can see here that we have a no under that. For example, under top level protections of exact match acronyms, it says no. So then, when we have the consensus call, then that won't be something that we could say yes or no to on an individual basis.
That is my plan, in fact.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Judd, I read you raised your hand for Jim, so Jim, please.
Yeah, Thomas, I just wanted to say that we, the IOC, is not seeking any fee waiver. That's it.
Thank you. That's helpful. Any more comments or remarks on the column dealing with the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement? In which case, I would suggest, Barry, that you proceed with showing us through the next column.
I think, Stefan, are you trying to raise your hand?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry,
guys. I forgot that. Stefan, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm not going to reiterate the points we've been making on the call for so many weeks now. So I do want to comment that we obviously for the record we maintain the positions that we have put forward throughout this process, and we cannot join what is called the consensus in this particular case, and some of the answers in this table. So we do need to know, you do need to understand that our positions do stand, and that we will, we will obviously continue to advocate for the extension of the protections, notably to the identifiers of the respective Red Cross, Red Crescent organizations. I personally continue to fail to understand how this working group, which was established to look at identifiers of organizations, which of course is a different approach to the previous IOC Red Cross Red Crescent working group, that proper consideration is not given. And I'll just make one remark, which is, in the past weeks the whole debate has been as to whether our request that the names and the acronyms of the international bodies within the Red Cross, Red Crescent organizations, the whole discussion has been as to whether this was new or not new, and so on and so forth. That's not where the issue lies, and I hope that we all agree that that's not the question. The question is whether there is a global public interest resulting from international and domestic law for the protections of these names. To us, it's absurd to protect, Red Cross .donate and not to protect Indonesian Red Cross .donate, considering that, if there is a tsunami in Southeast Asia, quite obviously, the name of the organization is just as much at risk of misuse. So of abuse. So I did want to take the floor to put on record that our positions are not changed, and that we cannot agree to the so-called consensus points that are in the table right now. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Stefan. And before I move to Greg, I would like to emphasize that certainly it is up to the working group to raise their voices, make themselves heard, that they do want to have scope 1 plus scope 2 identifiers protected. What you see in the chart is my assessment of the current views in the working group. That's what you see here. And Stefan, let me respond to your intervention that at least my view of the process of developing policy in the community is such that requires individual stakeholders to take compromise positions. Certainly that has a vital part of it that not everybody gets, or possibly not everybody gets 100% of what they wish for. But I can't change those dynamics. As chair, I have to take what the positions inside the working group are, and should that ultimately lead to a point where you can't even agree with the consensus position that has been developed in the community consultative process, and if other stakeholders do the same and vote, now I'm using mistakenly the word voting, but if they say they don't support the set of recommendations that have been put into the consensus call, then there will be no protection supported by the GNSO. It's as easy as that. If nobody is in a position to support what the working group has come up with as a consensus position, then we're sort of stuck. But again, I'd like to encourage all of you to let me know if you think that I have inaccurately reflected the level of consensus or the lack thereof in the table that you see in front of you. And with this, I'd like to move to Greg.
Thank you, Thomas. First, I'd like to applaud, which I'm doing virtually in the chat room, your statement regarding compromise. Second, to respond to Stefan, I would note that I sent a response that did not dwell on the issue of whether these were new asks or not, but went to the heart of what I felt were the issues that were being raised. So, at least speaking for myself, didn't dwell on the point of whether it's old or new requests, but just that these, requests are, in my point of view, some of them are a bridge, too far, or several bridges too far, or are, reflective of diversions from compromises that have been made for, other equally, worthy and appropriate organizations or stakeholders, and furthermore, that, when we speak of protection, we're speaking, there are a variety of different alternatives for ways that things can be protected. Reserve names is the zenith of protection. That's available, but it is not the only type of protection that's available. And I think, we have, shown a willingness to discuss various levels of protection for various types of identifiers. I think that, we're all trying to work toward consensus. It may not be full consensus. I think it insults the concept of consensus to call it so-called consensus. We have to understand that, the concept of consensus, as ICANN defines it, which is a level below full consensus, involves, some divergence, but it is still what ICANN as an ecosystem calls consensus, and the one under which we move forward, and which, I for one, support, as a workable concept. I just wanted to kind of point out that at least my comments were not, fairly characterized by Stefan. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. And, we can go back to column C if need be, please do consider both Stefan's and Greg's interventions, and, certainly it's up to the group to broaden the scope of protections and include the scope 2 identifiers in what's now been tagged scope 1. So please let me know, and if the level of support for a different position justifies so, I will certainly change the assessment of the consensus level. Barry, I guess we should move to column D now, and I'd like to ask you to talk us through the to the current state regarding the IOC.
Okay, thank you, Thomas. As we continue moving from column, Chuck raised his hand.
A procedural thing here. Do we really need to go by go through column by column? I thought what Barry did covered the whole row, not pretty much. Is there really value in going through column by column?
Well, in preparing for the call, I've extensively consulted with ICANN staff, and we thought that it might be a worthwhile exercise in order to make sure that everybody is heard and that we can grasp changes of the atmosphere in terms of consensus. But I would certainly be open to the suggestion of expediting this exercise.
Well, let me make a suggestion then. Why don't we just talk about each column, but see if there are any exceptions that anyone wants to communicate with regard to that column, rather than going through each of the columns item by item.
Well, unless there are any objections from working group members, I would be happy to follow that advice. And please, working group members, do let us know if you want to go through the items one by one. But for the time being, I'd like to pick up Chuck's suggestion. And Barry, maybe you could give us just a very high-level indication of where we're at to stimulate a discussion.
Absolutely. And for those that, you know, I think as we move from column to column, it's going to be easier and easier to grasp. So we did spend probably more time on Red Cross because it was the first one. But as we move from one group to the next, it'll be easier to quickly grasp what the recommendation options are being presented. So just to briefly move through the IOC, from a top-level perspective, they're identical to the Red Cross Red Crescent, that the full name identifiers are protected in the guidebook and that some sort of exception procedure would need to be created. And then, of course, acronyms, they didn't, the IOC didn't ask for any acronym protection. And then, again, there's no support for fee waivers. For the second level protections is almost identical to the Red Cross. However, so their scope one identifiers are the two identifiers that they've asked for, full match protection in spec 5. It's not applicable in regards to acronyms. Their trademark clearinghouse is not applicable because both of those identifiers are reserved within spec 5 of the list. Now, I think one aspect to notice here is, even though we're not recommending that these identifiers have access into Sunrise, there's nothing to say that the IOC would be prevented from entering other identifiers outside of the scope of our working group into the clearinghouse. It's only for the purposes of the identifiers being requested for protection here that are kind of within our scope. So hence, that's why it's not applicable across all of these options. Then, of course, again, the blanket, there seems to be strong support or almost near full consensus about access URS, UDRP, and then, I guess, of course, an exception procedure for their scope one name should they choose to register those two designations in any particular GPLD. And then again, lastly, the scope of identifiers is only those two names, Olympic Olympiad and the UN 6, plus German, Greek, and Korean, and again, which is currently outlined in Specification 5 of the registry agreement.
Any comments on this? Objections? Concerns? Okay. In which case, Barry, let's move on to column E.
All right. This is in regards to the IGOs. Again, at the top level, we'll go ahead and talk IGOs and INGOs at the top level because these are the same essentially for everybody. Their Scope 1 full name designations would be reserved in the applicant guidebook, and that some sort of exception procedure would need to be developed. And, again, just restating that there did not seem to be support for reservation at the top level of acronyms, nor for any fee waivers from the objection processes at the top level. Moving on to the second, Greg, you have your hand raised.
Yes, I just want to point out, and while, you know, if nobody else is joining it, it's obviously, you know, not a lot of support, but there, at least in the IPC, there was, you know, some support for the idea that acronyms that served as the primary identifier of an IGO, and for that matter, an INGO, you know, should be considered differently from acronyms in general. You know, the classic example being UNICEF. It doesn't even stand for what it used to stand for, but everyone knows that it's a UNICEF. A UNESCO may be another example. I don't know if there's an easy way that those are, you know, in, you know, parsed out from those that are not kind of primary identifiers of those organizations. But to protect United Nations Children's Fund, which is, I think, now what UNICEF is called, it used to be United Nations International Children's Educational, or maybe it was Emergency Fund, but not anymore. To protect, you know, that, you know, multi-word string, but not UNICEF, in that fashion seems upside down. But again, you know, if that's not something that others are, you know, might sign on to, and if there's not some way to have a mechanism whereby those exceptions could be made, it may go nowhere. But I did want to note that that variance from on the acronym point. Thank you.
Greg, if I may, I'd like to point out that looking at the ECOSOC list, there are acronyms on it. So in certain cases, the acronyms are actually listed. And I'm not sure whether, you know, we can easily fix that different treatment for certain acronyms, because it was my perception that the beauty of this approach would be to take a list on an as-is basis. But we can find ways to cope with this. I would certainly reflect that in my consensus assessment. Chuck, please.
Thanks, Thomas, and thanks, Greg. Just a point that if we were to go that direction, and I don't know whether we should or not, but the key would, as both of you have noted, is to find a way that's simple and objective to identify which acronyms would fit that category. That's the crux of it, I think, to me, if we were to go that route. I certainly understand Greg's point. Thanks.
I'd like to hear more views on that. Is that something that we need to open up? I guess there was at least some support from at large for acronym protections. We just heard Greg's suggestion. I would assume that Claudia is like-minded. Anybody else in favor of such protections and revisiting that? Greg, is that an old hand or a new hand?
It's a new hand. Just to point out, and I know this is a different data source than we've discussed, but the WIPO 6TER database, which covers IGOs that are protected under 6TER of the Paris Convention, includes both full names and acronyms that you know, have been registered in 6TER. So I would assume, not having done a scientific study, but would assume that the only acronyms are there, those that are kind of generally used by companies and not just those that are formed by happenstance and not actually used. But that is another potential resource. Not to open another can of worms, but just want to mention that. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg, and you're certainly right that 6TER of the Paris Convention mentions both names as well as acronyms. For INGOs, if we choose to use the ECOSOC list, unfortunately, at least I'm not aware of any mentioning of full names plus acronyms. I would very much like to hear whether there is more support for the protection of acronyms for INGOs. Stefan. Stefan, we can't hear you. Maybe your microphone is on mute.
Excuse me. Yes, as you will recall, we have also made the case that the acronyms of the international components of the Red Cross Red Crescent be also considered, and we had also formulated or agreed to the notion that some form of criteria be developed, which would identify the level of identification of a respective organization by its acronym. If you take, for example, the case of the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the acronym is even a part of our official logo. So that, for example, I think it is a signal of the level of association and identification of a given organization also by its acronym. Thank you. Or initial.
Thank you very much, Stefan. I guess it would be good for everyone to think about this, and we should get back to this next week. We're 6 minutes before the hour, so I guess we can't resolve that in its entirety today. I guess that the set of recommendations for the individual organizations as you see it in front of you also stems from the fact that even if there is no acronym protection at the top level, the risk of abuse might be relatively low at we're talking about the top level here because there is the opportunity to use objection mechanisms. There's the opportunity to discuss whether with the GAC whether GAC advice should be articulated on a specific string. So the question is there a big risk of any third party investing a substantial sum to infringe upon the acronyms of the organizations that would get the protections. So I guess we should take a look at this from all angles, think about the consequences, and for those who are supportive of acronym protections, please do share those with us prior to next week's meetings and also identify a workable approach to achieve that as objectively as possible to determine which acronyms should be protected and which should not. I guess it doesn't make too much sense for us to dive into the second level recommendations for IGOs and INGOs in this call. I hope that we will be able to conclude our conversation of the spreadsheet during next week's call, which will take place at the usual time next Wednesday. And Barry, you need to correct me if I'm wrong, or Mary. I guess pretty much the only topic on the agenda will be the completion of our discussion of the recommendations matrix, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, Chuck, I guess that's in your hand, please.
Thanks, Thomas. I'll be brief, but I'm thinking ahead the next steps, and knowing that David and I are going to have to go back to the, before we can actually participate in a consensus call, we're going to have to go back with the final list of things that looks like there's reasonable support for to the registry stakeholder group, and I assume everybody else will have to do that too when they're part of other groups. How are we going to use this spreadsheet in a maybe a little more simplified form and eliminating the no's and maybe narrowing the columns with check marks, something like that, that we can go back, use to easily go back to our stakeholder groups to get their input? Is that the intent? I know we don't need to finalize that now, but I am thinking ahead, assuming next week we can get through this. And then what's your thinking in terms of what we would present back to our stakeholder groups to get their input before we voice a position on the consensus call?
Well, the idea is that we work through this spreadsheet, as you said, eliminate the no's, but then formulate the tables into recommendations. So I guess it would be very welcome if you used the idea of what's in the table for consulting with your stakeholder group, but for the consensus call, I think we would not use the table format, but we would actually have written recommendations in a Word format. And if the group permits us to do so, we could start with this exercise before next week's call and take at least what we have so far and maybe also give you an idea of what the recommendations might be look like for the other subjects that we haven't yet discussed at the risk of, certainly revisiting them if the outcome should be different than we have it on the table at the moment.
Thank you.
Does that make sense for you?
Yes.
Would you favor a different approach to this? Something that might facilitate your interaction with the stakeholder group more than...
I think that's okay. When we get to that point, I'll probably have some suggestions with regard to the table to make it simpler but clearer, but that can come later.
Okay, perfect. So as I said, we will work on sort of provisional draft written recommendations formulated out of what's in the table now so that everybody in the group gets a better understanding of what the recommendations might look like should the discussions actually remain at the status that we have at the moment. And with this, I would like to thank everybody for their participation, for their comment, for the thought that they put into this. I think we're on an excellent path now, and I hope that we can keep up the momentum and complete our discussions on the recommendations next week. Thank you very much, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, all.